Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour, President Ulysses S. Grant, and specifically his heroic last year. Here is General William Tecumseh Sherman on Grant. It will be 1,000 years before Grant's character is fully appreciated. Here is Grant on Grant, although he was not normally a very funny guy. Describing his tone deafness, I know two tunes. One is Yankee Doodle, and the other isn't. That's pretty funny. And Julia Grant, his wife. I, his wife, rested in and was warmed in the sunlight of his loyal love and great fame. And now, even though his beautiful life has gone out, it is as if when some far-off planet disappears from the heavens, the light of his glorious fame still reaches out to me, falls upon me, and warms me. Our guest this hour is Charles Braceland Flood. He is the author of Grant's final victory, Ulysses S. Grant's Heroic Last Year. And Charles has written a number of other books, including Lee, The Last Years, and Grant and Sherman, The Friendship That Won the War, which Salon.com named one of the top 12 Civil War books ever written. Charles is past president of Penn American Center and has served on the governing bodies of the Authors League and the Authors Guild. He lives in Richmond, Kentucky. He's also author of 1864, A Portrait of Lincoln's Last Year in Office. This book is about the reversal of Ulysses S. Grant's financial stability, and it's also about his writing his memoir and the relationship between Grant and Mark Twain. It's a fascinating story, and what a thing to work on this memoir when you have been diagnosed with throat and tongue cancer and you are really in incredible pain, and how he stayed with this and wrote his memoirs. Charles is our guest this hour. We love doing these presidential histories. I hope you'll join the conversation, and I would imagine you will. Our number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. talk@wpr.org. Hello, Charles.
Hello. How are you, Kathleen?
I'm fine, Charles. How are you?
I'm fine, and I'm also very impressed that you, in the first minute of your introduction, skimmed off some of the, I think, very, very important points and touching things about this book.
Yeah, there are touching things about Grant. You don't think of him that way, but I love the part of the book that was the love story between Julia and Charles. It was just very touching.
Well, I want to say that Bruce Catton, the distinguished historian of the Civil War, said, or one of them, said of them, he said, this was the most beautiful, romantic of all the American love stories. And that's quite a sweeping statement, but I think I have enough about this in the book to support it.
And she was really, you write at one point in the book, that she was definitely his closest friend.
She supported him through almost unimaginable things. I mean, first of all, during the war, every time she could get near where he was, she came, and she sometimes was right in the middle of a cannon fire up the river and so forth, the James River, and at one point they thought a gunboat was coming down, the Confederate gunboat was going to break through some obstacles, get down the river, and start shelling the headquarters that she shared with Grant, and she said to him, well, Ulysses, what am I supposed to do? And he said, well, really, Julia, you shouldn't be here. He was the guy who had invited her.
Oh, my. Well, I think we have this idea about Grant was that he was terribly corrupt. His administration was corrupt. There are significant problems with him. You lay a lot of that to rest. You start the book by writing about the fact that the guy didn't really care all that much about money, and maybe he should have paid a little bit more careful attention to money.
Yeah. Well, if I may go back to the corruption in the White House, his first term was a success. His second term was not. But there were the political opposition, of which there was always plenty, had 37 separate investigations into corruption in his administration, and not one of them was able to nail Grant, despite how hard they tried. Now, what he did do, he was naive in a number of ways, and he trusted men he had every reason to trust, and they stabbed him in the back. They went out and enriched themselves at the public expense and, of course, at his reputation.
So he should have just been a little bit more careful about who surrounded him?
Right. And as far as money goes, we could explore that at quite some length. Shall we go there, Kathleen, or what would you like to do?
Oh, I don't know. Is it money or love?
Well, there's a lot of both in this book. But when we pick him up 20 years after Appomattox, he was living very well in New York City, but not out of his own profits, but because men like J.P. Morgan, Andrew Carnegie, and William H. Vanderbilt, the latter being the richest man in the world then with a net worth of $194 million, they'd all chipped in to help Grant live very pleasantly near their mansions on Fifth Avenue. And so he thought he was in pretty good shape. And what money he did have, he had invested in something called Grant & Ward, in which he was just really the silent partner, I mean, using his name. But he had no idea that what was going on was that this young partner named Ferdinand Ward, who was called the young Napoleon of Wall Street, was running a Ponzi scheme, which a later generation would call that, and also an even later generation, ours the last couple of years, would call a Bernie Madoff series of machinations. And so, anyway, one bright day in May of 1884, the whole house of cards came tumbling down, and Grant literally had no money left. And he went home from in the office downtown to, as you point out, his best friend and always his great supporter and unflappable Julia. And they looked, and he had in his wallet about, I think it was about $80, and she had in her cookie jar literally about $100 and some, and that's all they had, sitting in the middle of this handsome mansion just off of Fifth Avenue. And so I'll turn it back to you, but some very interesting developments came about thereafter.
And his son was the one who got him involved in this firm, wasn't he?
Yeah, his son was their best educated son, and had been on Wall Street some, but he had no idea. And many other investors, very bright, able investors, had invested with this Grant operation, Grant & Ward operation, so-called. And when it finally, these investors, the very day that they collapsed, these investors were being shown papers indicating that this firm had a capitalization of $16 million. This is at a time when you could hire a household servant for $5 a week. So when it all came down, a lot of people came down with it. When they actually had something on hand, real cash, this firm, not $16 million, but $17,000. So everybody was out. And it caused, shall we say, quite a scandal, quite a shock right through Wall Street.
And tell us about his service. I mean, it would be hard for us to believe in these days. Here's the guy who won the Civil War for the Union. He was president for two terms. Didn't he have some kind of pension?
No, that was what was fascinating about it. That was why his very skinflint father did not want him to run for president, because at that time presidents did not have a pension. But if you became president, you forfeited your army. In his case, he had a modest pension as an army retired army general, but so he became the president and he lost the pension.
Goodness.
So it was a unique and a very bad financial position.
I was really touched by the stories of people, Vanderbilt among them, who came forward to help him.
Yeah, and not only rich people, but he received money from his own veterans, you know, sending, this is just, don't even consider it a loan, thank you. This is for winning the war, this is for preserving the Union, this is for what you did for North and South at Appomattox and so forth. And he even got some contributions from Southern survivors of the war. So one of the, I think, things that this book clearly demonstrates is that 20 years after the Civil War, the North and the South still had serious issues, post-war issues, but that they all began to see that Grant was really a very, very fine man. And when, to jump just a little ahead, the news came that he had this cancer of the throat, there was a real outpouring of support and sympathy from both North and South.
Mm-hmm. And in this time when we have a hard time remembering what the word honor means and what civility means in politics all over the country, I'd like for you to talk a little bit more, because the book has some of the letters that he received from soldiers who served in the Confederacy, but the way that Grant treated Lee really made a huge impression on hundreds of thousands of people who served in the Confederacy.
It did. I still get a little almost choked up talking about it, but the point is, now here's Grant, the son of a tanner from Ohio, but hardly an American aristocrat, dealing at Appomattox with Robert E. Lee, who not only is a great soldier and a noble figure, but, you know, as one British man who came over during the war met him, he said, you're talking to a man who has the air of the oldest blood in the world. But anyway, it was Grant who, in some ways a bluff man, but in many, many ways at heart a very, very sensitive guy. He did everything in his power not only to make Lee feel at ease in one of the most uncomfortable meetings ever to take place in American history, but then he did things that just about knocked Lee over, like saying, well, you can send over to my commissary for all the food you want for your men, and your men, all of them, can take home their horses, that have horses, can take them home so they can put in a spring planting. And what Lee understood, they were both men who understood this kind of thing, what that was saying was, you can put in a crop that can take out this fall all over the South and save a lot of Southern children who would die this coming winter if you didn't have this. So Lee walked out of there and never allowed a word against Grant to be said during the remaining 5 years of his life. And there's even one follow-up. And that, when that got around through the South, it meant a lot, too. Andrew Johnson had become the president after from being vice president after Lincoln's assassination. And he wanted to arrest Grant and try him, I'm sorry, arrest Lee, try him for treason, and could have hanged him, and I think was in a mood to do that. Grant walks into the White House, gets hold of Johnson, and says, if you arrest Lee, I will resign as General-in-Chief of the United States Army and let everybody know why I'm doing it. Well, Johnson and his federal prosecutors had no intention of this, you know, doing this, which would leave them at odds with the immensely popular, victorious commanding general of the United States Army, popular in the North. So they never arrested Lee, and Lee, on his part, never allowed a word against Grant to be said in his presence for the rest of his life. So it's pretty touching, and as you say, it's about military honor, a new standard of military honor internationally. It's about gentlemen. It's about honor. It's about civility. And I think you're right. It's something we might well remind ourselves about today. Yeah. This book will do it.
And where did Grant get that? Did he get it from reading? Did he get it from childhood? Because it's rather unique, the depth of it.
Yeah. Well, I think and I'm not a West Pointer. I'm a military historian. I'm written about quite a bit. I think West Point did it a little bit for him. Duty, honor, country, and they were all gentlemen, those men in the Army, and it's interesting that they also, a lot of them, had fought together in the Mexican War. And so there was an element, even at Appomattox, strained as it was, of sort of a West Point reunion. And I think that Grant just had always been a very, very honest man, and as I say, almost naive in certain ways about other people and their lack of honesty or potential lack of honesty. And so what he brought to Appomattox was just, I think the great thing is that he brought democratic middle America from Ohio. And that was before they ever had the term the Middle West. He brought what I consider to be Middle Western values, not exclusively, but certainly honor to the Middle West, to that table. And if I could just digress, or not digress, but just say one more thing. When it became clear that he had this situation on hand of racing the clock or the calendar to finish his volume, a two-volume, massive and very impressive personal memoirs that he was writing, with a whole generation of young people who hadn't been born at Appomattox started writing him fan letters. And it seems that is something also that was entirely new to me in this book. And, you know, young girls writing him saying, "I hope it doesn't hurt too much. Please get well. We all love you." And it's pretty touching. And here's this guy, you know, who doesn't come over today as a great popular hero, comes over as a deficient president, this and that. But in his day, he was very, very much appreciated, North and South.
Mm-hmm. So would you agree then with General Sherman, it will be 1,000 years before Grant's character is fully appreciated?
Well, it certainly has taken a long time to get this far. What we have right now is a sort of counter-revision movement, I think, that, of which I'm happy to be a small part. But to give you an idea of the reappraisal, Professor Sean Willance, a very fine scholar at Princeton, contends that Grant did more for civil rights in this country than any other president between Lincoln and Lyndon B. Johnson. And that's quite a claim, and I think you know, of your listeners, I doubt that 1 in 100 would even have heard that ever contended.
We're going to go to phone calls for our guest in just a moment. His name is Charles Braceland Flood, and his book is titled Grant's Final Victory, Ulysses S. Grant's Heroic Last Year. We have yet even to talk about Mark Twain. Don't worry, we'll get to it in a moment. Here's our number, 800-486-8655. Our email, if you'd like to use that, is talk@wpr.org. talk@wpr.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to phone calls now for our guest, and let's start with Scott in La Crosse. Hi, Scott.
Hi there, Kathleen.
Hi.
I'm enjoying the show a lot.
Good.
It sounds like a great book.
It is.
I'm glad you think so.
So am I, Scott.
My question for you, sir. First of all, one of the things that I remember hearing about that moved me about his final year was that he, I guess, was in a house in upstate New York someplace.
That's correct. He spent the last 5 weeks of his house, I'm sorry, of his life in a house just north of Saratoga Springs in New York. The idea was to get him out of New York, what would probably be near the end of his life, because New York was hot and even malarial in the summer at that time.
Yeah, and what I heard was he'd be out on the porch writing, and there would be just about a constant parade of his old veterans who would just march by and just salute their old commander, not really, you know, just to pay their respects. And I thought, well, you know, that says something about the man, doesn't it? But the question I had for you, sir, was I had heard that the GAR, the Grand Army of the Republic, wound up being a very, very powerful, we call it a lobbying group today, I guess, for the rest of the 19th century. And I just wondered if in your research you found what Grant's relationship with that organization was.
Yeah, that's a very, very interesting question. The answer is he was never, I'm not sure I even heard you right, he was never anything in the way of an official in that particular very powerful lobbying organization, as you say. It was the equivalent, I don't know of even what today, the American Legion or something like that. And so he was the head, very much the titular head, of a couple of lesser veterans organizations, just because he felt he should be. But he never took any significant role in that. However, you're certainly right, and I think it'd be worth a book for somebody to step in and do it. The GAR was a very powerful outfit, and for instance, they tried to get Sherman to run for president, and Sherman did this wonderful thing of saying, you know, if nominated, I will not accept, or something like. Even if nominated, I will not run. So they didn't get anywhere with those two great survivors of the of that time. But it is a good point. But Grant was very encouraging to any veterans organization. He believed in them, and you know, he wrote a rather touching letter about a reunion that he couldn't go to, and he said, just tell my boys in blue I'll always be thinking of them, meaning he knew he was on the way out, and he wouldn't be at the next reunion the next year, but he certainly was all for them. And also, if I could just digress for a minute on this, it wasn't just up in Saratoga Springs, it was called Mount McGregor, but also in New York City, sometimes these veterans and on crutches and stuff would just come and stand outside his house, and often when the weather was good, he would go outside, even though he was now had something the size of two bird's eggs on the side of his neck, and he had this these lumps and so forth. But he would just get out to get into a carriage to be taken for a ride in Central Park, and there'd be crowds outside, and the men would either, you know, the men and women would applaud. Some of the women would curtsy. The men would raise their hats respectfully, and it was very, very touching, that kind of outpouring, which we don't associate with Grant. And he didn't. He was a modest man. He really, really didn't thirst for that the way certain leaders we've had in recent times, and I mean of both parties, like that stuff.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks, Scott. Always a great pleasure to hear from you, Scott. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. We're halfway through the show, and we haven't even talked about Mark Twain yet, who figures prominently, so we must do that. And first, start with give me a little more background on Twain serving in the Confederacy and then deserting. I didn't know that story.
That's a beautiful story.
It's quite a story.
I'm so glad you start there. And the punchline on this, Grant never discovered this particular thing, but in any case, at the beginning of the Civil War, Twain joined something called Rawls Rangers, which was a very, very makeshift, slipshod Confederate militia unit. All that I'm about to talk about happened on the west side of the Mississippi, on the banks there. And the fact was that this Rawls Rangers group was supposed to defend some of the west side of the Mississippi, and they knew that sooner or later there'd be Union troops coming down. But this group elected Mark Twain, who had not a day of military experience, as one of their lieutenants. That'll give you an idea of what sort of outfit they were. And when some real good Confederate officers would come along from time to time, desperate to get some sort of potential defense going, they would just tell them to forget it. We're doing our thing. And so they would, they were supposed to defend some of these farms, which were then occupied only by the wives of men who were fighting with the Confederate Army somewhere else. And they would come in and politely say, ma'am, we're taking over your barns, we'd like to sleep in your barns, and by the way, we're hungry, could you cook us some food? And then the next day, after this had been done, the supposed defenders would say thank you and ride a little farther south to stay out of potential trouble. Well, anyway, sooner or later they heard that a real live Union Army regiment was coming down the river, and they all dispersed and deserted, and Mark Twain got on a horse and didn't stop till he got to Nevada. Okay, so later he meets Grant, and they do indeed become friends. But what Grant never knew, I think Grant could have stood it, that Grant, the West Pointer, could have certainly understood that a man from Missouri, which is a border state, would have joined the Confederate Army. I don't think that was any problem to him at all. I don't think he would have liked it much, and I don't think he ever knew to know that his friend, Mark Twain, who never certainly told him this, not deserted and drove all the way to Nevada to stay out of trouble. And then the final thing, which neither one of them ever put together until years and years after the deaths of both of them, was that the commander of the regiment coming down that side of the river was none other than Ulysses S. Grant.
Oh, my gosh, Charles.
But they certainly never met on the field of battle, because Twain made sure it wouldn't happen.
What a story that is.
It's a great story. It's a very little-known story, and one of the many pleasures I had of encountering this stuff in the book.
Let's go back to phone calls. Rob in Radisson. Hi, Rob.
Good morning. Thank you for the program. Yes, I have a question. I was wondering if, in your book, if there is any discussion of President Grant's dealings with Chief Red Cloud or of the Bighorn Association that was formed in Cheyenne, Wyoming, and its members believed in Manifest Destiny, which I believe Grant also believed in.
No, I will tell you that what happened with Grant, I mean, the answer is I do not mention that specifically. What I will say is this, that Grant tried very hard for a policy on the Indians that differed quite a bit from Sherman and later Sheridan. And their policy really was the only good Indian is a dead Indian. And Grant tried very, very hard to protect the Indians. But then, unfortunately, during the end of his second term, came Custer's massacre at the Little Bighorn. And at that point, Grant felt, well, I've used up all my political clout and influence and so forth here, and I just can't go on trying to defend, have a policy that is pro-Indian, and that he pretty well walked away from that.
Thank you, Rob, so much for your call. Ernest in Viroqua, hi.
Hello, good morning. There's a Wisconsin connection from the Viroqua area. Governor Rusk from Viroqua, governor of the state of Wisconsin, was the first Secretary of Agriculture, and spoke at Grant's, gave the eulogy at Grant's funeral, and Grant's staff commissioned a ice water urn, which is owned by the LaBelle Masonic Lodge of Viroqua and is in the Historical Society in Viroqua, with all their names on it. So they all had, I'm sorry, I'm quite nervous, but...
Oh, don't be nervous.
That's perfectly okay. And I'm listening not only patiently, but with great interest, because I don't pretend to know about this. It's news to me.
Right.
And I'll try to look at it for my own curiosity, even after the book is out. I want to learn more about this. Go ahead, please.
They all three were Masons and had a Masonic connection, which would have superseded... would have been helpful for them in their friendships as Masonic brothers. But that urn is in the Vernon County Historical Society.
That's very interesting. I want to tell you, there's no evidence that Grant was a Mason. And one reason that I mention it is that a Masonic group in New York City that had quite a fine chorus came and serenaded him on his sort of front stoop outside his very handsome house on East 66th Street, and he came outside and, you know, took off his hat and bowed to them and so forth. Didn't say anything, but listened to their medley of songs and then went back into his house. And I think some people thought that a fellow lodge member was being honored, but there's no evidence, and I looked into it, that he was a Mason himself, which is no commentary on anything else. But I'm very interested in what you also have to offer here, and I thank you.
Thank you, Ernest, so much for your call. You never need to be nervous calling the show because it's just us, and what you have to say is interesting. So that's what guides the conversation. We need to talk about his illness for a moment. The moment when he was eating that peach really struck me and was writhing in pain. Ooh, I'll forever remember that. I'll always, because of your book, associate that with Ulysses Grant, who smoked too many cigars, I guess. Huh?
That's what happened. He was, at that time, Twain had not yet appeared on his horizon, and he was trying to write some articles for a good magazine called the Century Magazine, but for what was really very, very small amounts of money. And he was in Long Branch, New Jersey, where he and Julia were for the summer in a cottage. And I might add that Julia, who for 8 years had had the White House staff at her disposal, did all the cooking for the family and friends there. And, you know, she really was the stand-by-your-man woman for all seasons. But in any case, so he was eating a peach, and so it hurt his throat. And everybody, including him, thought, well, something in the pit of the peach must have pricked his throat. But that was the beginning, as you say, Kathleen, those thousands of cigars that finally hit their mark. And the disease developed pretty quickly. And as I say, when the nation understood that he was then, Twain had appeared and did say, look, just, you know, write your memoirs and I'll get you out of your financial trouble. And you'll have plenty of money left for Julia after you're gone. And that's about this as boldly as it was all put. And Grant said to him, how do you know I can write at all? Twain said, you wrote the best, most direct, unmistakable orders and after-action reports that anybody has written. And so he pulled, they were going back and forth, he pulls out of his checkbook, he says, let's not fool around. I'll write you a check for $50,000 now. I'll give you a total advance of $200,000 now. And he said, I'm sure I'll make $100,000 before the year is out. Well, the answer is everybody made a lot more money than that. But I think what was really interesting and even thrilling was that although Twain was sure he had a winner, when he saw what Grant was writing, at a time when Grant said that something like drinking just a glass of water was like molten lead.
Oh, my.
So Grant was turning this stuff out at an average of 750 words a day, day after day after day. And Twain wrote this very eloquent sort of reaction and said, this is as good as Julius Caesar's commentaries. And it's beautiful, he said. This is literature of the highest order, all of which it is, and to this day still sells about 50,000 copies a year, plus you don't know how many copies are downloaded since the copyright is gone. But it's a very good story as a publishing story, as a story of courage, as a story of determination, and Grant had just tremendous powers of concentration. And what I think is also interesting, and I think the book will demonstrate this, is it's so seldom in all of history that you can have somebody who makes history and then writes beautifully, beautifully, and effectively about it. And the last person I can think of who did this was Winston Churchill. He made history, and then he got the Nobel Prize for Literature. So it's a significant story.
Yes. Larry in Green Bay is our next caller. Hi, Larry.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I'd like to read the author's book. I read Grant's memoirs last summer.
Oh.
And really spent a lot of time with it. Oh, yeah, all 817 pages. And, you know, I think three things I came away with, or maybe more than three. The guy was very enigmatic. You know, you could just get little snatches. You had to really spend a lot of time with the book to try to understand them. And the second thing was is that he really wanted to make an assertion that what he called the South a military despot that was, you know, conscripting people between 16 and 60. And if you weren't fighting, they were trying to get you back into the lineup to fight. And they fought till they had nothing left, essentially. So it was really interesting. And he said the press was involved in it. And in one chapter, when he took Richmond, the townspeople and the press told that their people that the North had actually been driven from Virginia, and they took Richmond the next day. So they really lied to their people, and these guys had actually, the officials of Richmond had escaped, according to his memoir, like the day before he took it. But at the same time, we're telling their people that. And then the last thing was, at the end of the book, he kind of gives a synopsis of, you know, the, like, Custer, all the different generals, and but all through it, he's very gentlemanlike, and at the beginning of the book, he says, you know, he doesn't want to make anyone look bad, but it was quite the work. I think, I want to say Twain called it a masterpiece, and I think Twain's publishing company went broke after that was the only book they published, but the author would know better. So.
Well, you're right about everything except the very last thing, which was that he actually had, yeah, that publishing company was more or less created by Twain just to publish the book. And it made a lot of money, but Twain was a terrific gambler in his own right. So he got stuck on things like something called a Crayola type machine, which had nothing to do with Grant's memoirs, but the money he was making in one thing, he was always pouring off into some new idea or new invention and so on. So in a sense, you're right, he created this, he actually had his nephew, Charles Webster, create this little publishing company for the purpose of Grant's memoirs. And I think whoever still has whatever rights remain, but I think a copyright, you know, has expired. But a lot of people, and certainly Julia, which was Grant's whole intention, and he made her the executor as well, she lived very comfortably for the rest of her life. And I think some other members of his family also had some money for quite a while. So other than the fact that I think, you know, I'm not saying you're even wrong on that last point, but they didn't go broke on the book. That's all I'm trying to say.
Isn't it remarkable that he was able to do that for her, because that's what he wanted to do for her? And here he was so sick, yeah. And yet he could still write, and he accomplished the very thing that he had set out to do, Charles.
And again, to go back to Julia, she called it his labor of love, because she understood exactly what his motivation was. It was not for fame, and it wasn't even, you know, he wanted to give credit to where it was due. And in some cases, as your last caller suggested, there's something less than praise for a few people, including General Lew Wallace, who later wrote Ben-Hur and became quite a famous figure for that reason. But yes, it was a labor of love. And one of the things that I didn't understand until I got into well, this almost series of Civil War books, because Grant's in there somewhere, everywhere, how much he cared about his family. He really was deeply, deeply devoted and almost ferociously protective of the different members of his family. They came first, and all other things came second.
Hmm. And back to Twain for a moment. Tell us this story, because it's kind of a humorous story. When the two met, first met in 1869, I believe it was.
Well, what happened was that because Twain got out to Nevada, what would you do in Nevada if you were Mark Twain? Well, you'd start writing successful stories about mining camps and so forth, and then you would become an aide to the senator from Nevada. And so this brought him back to Washington in a fairly, not if prestigious, but, you know, staffers in Washington have a lot of influence. So one day this senator says to Twain, well, I'm going over to see the president about something. In those days, if you were a senator, you could just walk right in. And would you like to come along and meet the president? Well, so they walk in, and Grant is obviously very busy. And the senator says, Mr. President, I'd like you to meet, his name had not become Mark Twain, then Samuel Clemens. And Grant gives him the most perfunctory handshake, the most perfunctory, God, I wish I didn't have to do this kind of, not even a smile, just a look, and then drops Twain's hand. And Twain thinks he ought to say something more, being Mark Twain. He wants to act it out in words, and he says, Mr. President, I'm embarrassed, are you? And Grant just looks at him, what is this nutcase doing in here? And just doesn't even say anything, just nods and, in effect, turns to the senator and says, take your boy away here, you know. And so anyway, 7 years later they meet. In the meantime, now they're the two most famous men in America. Twain has written Tom Sawyer. He's about to publish Huckleberry Finn. Everybody knows who he is. And they're reintroduced on an occasion in Chicago when actually Sherman was going to be honored and his army veterans were going to walk past and march past and so forth. Anyway, so somebody brings him up to Grant, who had a memory like the Republican elephant that he was. And before Twain can say a word, and Twain doesn't know what he ought to say, but Grant sticks out his hand and says, Mr. Twain, I'm not embarrassed, are you?
Oh, isn't he remembered? Oh, my goodness.
They were always good friends. And when Grant was in this Grant Ward job, if you could recall it, that down in Wall Street, he would sometimes have friends in for lunch, and Twain was always welcome to come in for lunch. So when Grant got into trouble, Twain certainly saw an opportunity for himself, but he wanted to help a friend, and they were great, great friends. And the day that Grant died, and as you know from the book, it was tremendous outpouring and tremendous funeral procession, all that in Manhattan. And Twain did not want to be a part of this in any way. He was going to meet Sherman, who was very prominently a part of it, later at a private club in New York, and nobody kept a record of that conversation because between the two of them, it must have been quite a conversation. But anyway, that day, in his own diary, Twain said he was in his own way, is a great man and a superlatively good man. And I think so many people began to realize this was a good man, a man you could admire.
More phone calls in just one moment. We're talking about Ulysses S. Grant this hour with the author of Grant's Final Victory, Ulysses S. Grant's Heroic Last Year. Charles Braceland Flood is our guest, and he's written a number of books, 12 other books, including the best-selling Lee, The Last Years, and Grant and Sherman, named one of the top 12 Civil War books ever written. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. One line is open. The email is talk@wpr.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Paul, our next caller from Luck. Hi, Paul.
Hi.
Hi.
Thank you, Mr. Flood, for the wonderful program and finally giving some credit to my personal historical hero whose picture I keep on my refrigerator.
Oh.
Well, good for you.
And personally
you.
Celebrate
and by
birthday.
The way, you're the wave of the future here. He is coming back. I mean, I don't say he ought to be on Mount Rushmore, but he's finally getting his proper place in American history.
And that is great. I have a comment about Appomattox.
Yes, sir.
I think General Lee had awfully good counsel from Grant's old pal at West Point, General Longstreet, who's also I hold in high esteem, which states that Longstreet knew the character of Grant. And my question is, do you think General Grant's reputation still suffers from the negativism of the press, the Union press?
Well, that's a very good question. I think, as I say, I think something long overdue is now taking place. And you raise a very interesting and pretty sophisticated question. At the end of the 19th century, he was held in high esteem. And I'll give you an idea of how high that esteem was. Theodore Roosevelt, in 1900, in a speech, singled him out. He said, well, we've had wonderful citizens like Benjamin Franklin and Thomas Jefferson, but he said that looking back through history, he believed the three greatest Americans were George Washington, Abraham Lincoln, and Ulysses S. Grant. And he said that among the three, obviously a different time for Washington, they had stood there in the van of civilization, as he saw it, in the two times that liberties were under the greatest attack. I won't go into the subject of the American Revolution and War of Independence, etc., for the moment, but his point is that Lincoln and Grant, between them, preserved the Union and meant that this country would go on as one nation rather than as two nations, one of which at the time had, as a matter of law, that slavery was legal. So it's quite a, you know, that's how he was regarded. Now, what happened in the 20th century, and it's very interesting and very little known, is that a lot of historians, including some from the North, decided they wanted to, you know, Lee didn't need to be elevated any farther, but they felt to put Lee further up, and they were, and I'm all for the reality of the bravery of the Confederate Army and Army of Northern Virginia, all for that. It's all true. But they wanted to put all that up and create the great thing of the lost cause and so forth. So they felt to do that, they had to put Grant down, and they went about it pretty savagely. And so that went on for a long time. As late as 1992, you had a respected Northern historian saying he didn't see how Grant, a pathological killer, could look himself in the mirror. Now, just let me just take that one step further. At Cold Harbor, the one attack that Grant said he wished he had never ordered, in the first hour, 7,000 Union soldiers were killed. Okay, and who was in these very well-constructed defenses supervising all this? Robert E. Lee. Mm-hmm. Does that make Robert E. Lee a pathological killer or just make him a very good general? But you see the way this playing field was constructed, and only now are people coming back. I mean, students of this coming back saying, wait a minute. Grant had his failings, but he certainly wasn't a villain. Also, he was a very bright man, and that is, you only have to study the Vicksburg campaign and a few other things to see that. I could go on with that for a moment or two, but I think there are probably other dimensions to this. But you raise a very good question, and I think the answer is we'll get to an appropriate balance here reasonably soon,
and
the way it's going.
Are you talking primarily about historians or the press, the New York papers, et cetera?
Well, really both. I mean, it really was gang up on Grant for a long, long time. Mm-hmm. So I think it's pretty hard to divide the two. So I think I'd rather leave it at that and see what else.
And what picture is on the refrigerator, Paul?
It's a picture of Grant that I've cut out of, I don't recall where. And it has his birthday on it. After I read his memoirs, I enjoy reading about Grant.
Yeah, thank you. Thanks very much for the call. He was a pretty good-looking guy, wasn't he? I normally don't think that about people, but there is something about him, his face, that's just, it has this kindness about it.
Yeah, well, you're right. I mean, you're supposed to be this pathological killer, and apparently when you really looked at his face, according to the people, you know, who had the opportunity to do that, they're really quite kindly eyes. And I would like to throw in one more vintage thing because, again, at the time, Prince von Bismarck, the Iron Chancellor of Germany, this isn't that well known, Grant and Julia went on a 2-year trip around the world after he was president. So von Bismarck wanted to see Grant because he knew that Grant had a lot of firsthand, both military and political experience that he wanted to tap. So here comes the story, which I'll try to keep brief. So it was arranged that Grant was going to be received at this palace where Bismarck both lived and had his office, and at 4 o'clock on an afternoon. So the officer of the guard was told to be ready for a carriage to roll up from the American embassy with an American flag, you know, little flag up front, and that Grant would descend from this, the 2-time president of the United States. And so this Prussian officer had his guard ready for this. And so, well, being Grant, he didn't do any of that. He just walked down the street from his hotel, smoking a cigar, came through the outer gates of the palace, and went into the courtyard, threw his cigar to one side, and came walking across the courtyard. Now, here's the point that gets back to you, Kathleen. So what this officer sees is this man walking across the courtyard, who's obviously got a certain presence and a certain look about him, an attractive look, and as if he knew this guy coming toward him, knew who he was, what he was, what he was doing, and so forth. So the guard had the wit to think, well, this isn't the carriage I expected, but I think we'd better turn out the guard and salute. And Grant, sort of just being a military man, sort of just raised his hat in return and went in and had this talk with Bismarck. But again, there are these episodes that a lot of people don't really know about that are they're worth knowing about because they're all clues to the man. He was just Ulysses S. Grant. Why did he need a carriage? He needed a little stroll, and he strolled down the avenue and went in to chat with Bismarck, and just they met as equals, you know?
Yeah. Paul, thank you. We have about a minute left. Ron in La Crosse. Hi, Ron.
Yes. I'd just like to say Grant had a couple peculiarities. He had a violent prejudice against men who parted their hair in the middle.
That's true. At the time, that was true, but also the men who parted their hair in the middle wore them down sort of almost shoulder length. It was considered, I don't think he was a homophobe, but it was considered rather a feat and so forth. And again, West Point had left its mark on Grant. There's no question about it. You're correct about that.
Huh. Let's go to Bob in Richland Center. Hi, Bob.
Hi, good morning, Kathleen. I'd like to know about Grant's connection to Galena, Illinois. He has a home there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've seen that one. We have about 30 seconds.
Yeah, that was where he went off to the war from Galena. And to go on beyond that, I'm afraid just we don't have the time. But you're perfectly right. And he's got there's a house there that's been preserved as an historic house and so on. And that is indeed where he just strolled out of there behind a unit that was being called up. He was not yet officially attached to any unit. He was just going off voluntarily to offer his services to the Union.
Mm. Well, Charles, please join us again. I really enjoyed the hour.
Well, I enjoyed it very, very much. I happen to be a big fan of NPR. And if I may say so, I happen, though I'm in Kentucky, to really like the Green Bay Packers for a couple of reasons, and I'm sorry they didn't have a good day the other day.
Well, thank you, and I really like Kentucky to return the favor.
Well, thank you.
You're
so
welcome.
Much.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Goodbye. Goodbye. Charles Braceland Flood. The book is Grant's Final Victory, the fascinating look at Ulysses S. Grant's heroic last year. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing the hour, and thanks to Chrissy Pease for on-air production here in our downtown Milwaukee studios. Great conversations yet to happen.